Okay, good afternoon, Professor Van Hemmen. Thank you very much for joining us. As we've discussed ahead of time, the purpose of this interview is to go over the period during which replica symmetry breaking was formulated, which we, in physics, which we bound roughly from 1975 to 1995. But before we get to that, I'd like to ask a few questions on background. In particular, how did you first get interested in physics? And then what led you to pursue a PhD in mathematical physics?
I got interested in physics in Dutch grammar school. Dutch grammar school is, let's be honest, just for 2% of the kids. We had five foreign languages, French, German, English, and added to that, to those, Greek and Latin, which we should master actively on an academic level. Well, during this time, when I passed to the university, I had decided that why study physics? I could answer that question already in those days by means of a single sentence. Mathematically formulating physical reality. That's my goal. That's what I want. That's what I've wanted all my life and is still my goal, mathematically formulating physical reality. Of course, you can become philosophical and then discuss what mathematically means and what reality means. But just if you want a one sentence description, there it is. That's why I voted for chose physics. Of course, you can say you could have chosen something else. Well, at my time, I've pondered about, say, mathematical economy. But mathematical economy wasn't as far as physics yet. And when I started, it has a 400 years tradition of mathematical formulation. So it was far more challenging, though I took a serious look at it. Okay, I hope this answers the question, why study, why do physics? Not to do experiments. I think an experiment is a complete waste of time as soon as you've seen that the interesting stuff is in its mathematical description. So for me, doing experiments is wasting my time, but be that as it may. If you want to do and act differently, fine, go ahead. I don't care. I do need them, the experimentalist. It's extremely important. If you become a theorist, you should always have an intensive contact with the experimentalist that do the physics you are working on. Otherwise, you may develop a wonderful theory, but most probably good for nothing. At least that's what I'm not too fond of.
How did you get to pursue a PhD in Groningen then? What was your drive to
pursue very research? Simple. I was born in the city of Groningen, so I'm a true Groninger.
Okay.
And Groningen has an old university. It's the second oldest university in Holland. Leiden was founded in 1578 or so, and Groningen is 1614. 1614. Huh? For Americans, 1614, folks. Look for the university that was founded in 1614. The Sorbonne, of course, is older, but nah, yeah. It's a decent age. It's a good university, and in fact, mathematics and physics were at my time excellent. So why move to Amsterdam if you have a very good university at your hometown? I did.
You then moved on to a first postdoc at near Paris, right, to work with David Ruel. What was the drive to go there and to work with him?
L'Institut de Haute Etude Scientifique, Bourg-sur-Yvette, lovely place. I was able to move to the IHES because actually my goal was working with Joel Lebowitz. And Joel had a year off at the IHES. Indeed, I also interacted with Ruel. Ruel is absolutely great. I solved a few problems for him, but say the real goal of my stay was Joel Lebowitz. And as you know, Joel was the center of the statistical mechanical universe, so that fits.
So and from there you moved to the US actually to take, I think, was it a visiting assistant professor position in mathematics at Duke? Why?
I was, say, interested. First, it was an assistant professorship. That's nice to get some experience. I have to admit, however, that my wife didn't like it at Duke. So in spring, when our first son was coming, she told me, "Leo, I see you like it here very much. I don't. If you want to stay, well, fine. But for next year, I'll be gone." Well, what are you going to do? I was quite lucky. And when I arrived at Duke, Richard Palmer had just arrived. So we both started our first year as assistant professors with all the ins and outs at Duke. He in physics, a floor below me, and I in mathematics. And we quickly got into contact. He explained to me what a spin glass was supposed to be. I immediately got interested because I have a strong background in probability theory. And there we go. You may know that Richard and I have written, meanwhile, a rather well-known paper.
We'll get to that. I'd like to talk a few more.
Okay, but that was the upshot of our first collaboration at Duke. So that's why I immediately got involved rather heavily into spin glasses. Very simple.
So before diving into spin glasses, what drove your problem selection up until that point, right? What led you to pursue certain questions?
I would say accident. If you arrive at a new place, meet an interesting person, or interesting is of course a subjective definition. You may not find at all interested what I'm saying. So, or find, oh gosh, the guy is utterly boring. But be that as it may, if you meet an interesting person, and get fascinated by the problem. Richard was really very excited about the spin glass problem. And he could convince me to a large extent immediately. So you are at a new place, you meet a new problem, as background, I got my PhD in equilibrium statistical mechanics. I picked the problem myself. My thesis advisor agreed, oh yeah, Leo, that's a very nice one. And he allowed me to pursue completing a dissertation in dynamics and ergodicity of the infinite harmonic crystal. So it was an a priori infinite system. In those days, that was very popular. To study equilibrium statistical mechanics, you should take the system a priori infinite. Taking all these thermodynamic limits is so boring. Just start with the infinite system. The idea looks nice, but constructing a dynamics of an infinite system is damned hard. And until now, it has not been done yet. You need some bounds. But the harmonic crystal was a nice example of an infinite dynamical system that you could solve exactly. That's what I did, constructed the phase space and constructed a dynamics on which that must be based on a phase space. And only then can you indicate an equilibrium state. That's a measure on a phase space that is invariant under the dynamics. And then you can talk about ergodicity, Well, that's what I did in Kuzhou, that it's at the top of the ergodic hierarchy. And you have ergodic, weakly mixing, strongly mixing, Bernoulli. This all this stuff is the ergodic hierarchy, and Aikuchou, it's a Bernoulli system, so it's equivalent to playing cards, which is completely random if the cards are not faked. So it's damned ergodic. That was the background, so it was decently good in dynamics and really interested in dynamics. And then comes the spin glass system, and equilibrium is also a notion, of course, as one of the last representative of the classical Dutch school of equilibrium statistical mechanics. That looked very attractive, meeting then Richard Palmer at Duke. Okay, let's see what can be done. And then the first question is, what apparently that was in those days a fascinating problem, characterize the transition to the spin glass state. What kind of transition is it? Well, what state does the spin glass lands into? This type of question fascinated me because of my background. I admit equilibrium statistical mechanics was, though I realized when I left Groningen, equilibrium statistical mechanics is over, we need to turn to something else. And then came Richard Palmer with spin glasses. Oh, that looks cute. So it all fit rather nicely. That's why I started there, and have continued until I developed my own spin glass model, but that's presumably for later. So the motivation, you have the right context, a colleague to talk to. Duke in those days was a very nice place. I loved it there. Let's be honest, your surroundings, where you work, are really important to make you creative for a decent amount of time. Duke belonged to those places. At least I experienced it that way. And what I hinted at, my wife didn't like it there. She loved it in Paris. She had finished her studies in French linguistics, and Paris in those days was the Mecca of modern French linguistics, so that was perfect. But at Duke, it was just the opposite. And that was one of the reasons, no. Students were reading their French literature in English translation. Well, okay, that's not quite what my wife was used to. And that was an extra motivation to return to Europe. But be that as it may.
So you mentioned that first work with Richard Palmer and its genesis. So what was the reaction to that work?
First, I would say a pleasant surprise. Hey, there is an exactly soluble model. You do not need esoteric mathematics to solve it.
Sorry, I meant your first paper with Richard about the SK model. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's the point.
Okay.
There was the replica method to solve the SK model. And people were wondering, why is the solution, it looks reasonable, but there must be something wrong. The entropy as the temperature goes to zero is negative. That shouldn't be. What is wrong there? So I told Richard, look, we have to see what precisely is going wrong. Well, working on it, we discovered that the key notion that we needed there was the theory of convex functions. You have to know, when you do equilibrium statistical mechanics, what Sherrington and Kirkpatrick had solved was or had solved, they obtained a solution for the free energy, that's the equilibrium statistical mechanics free energy, at any temperature, fine, on the basis of a really cute procedure, the replica method. And so this is all equilibrium statistical mechanics. You get the free energy, then you differentiate a few times and you get the energy and the specific heat and and then, oh, well, the specific heat was linear at low temperatures, but the entropy was negative, which, as we all know, cannot be. How is that? And that's the point. But the free energy is a convex function of the inverse temperature beta. And the statistical, we had to take the thermodynamic limit. And in the thermodynamic limit, that was a hot discussion, are you interchanged at replica limit? And you have first a number of replicas. So the partition function raised to the power n, you can compute it. The average of z to the n, that's what you can compute for n integer, not, of course, for n non-integer. Then for each positive integer, you have an explicit expression, and then you take the evident extension to a neighborhood of zero, and then you differentiate that at n is zero, and that should give the free energy, the log z, z to the n, differentiated with respect to n at n is zero, and you get log n. So, cute idea. Why didn't it work? And then applying the theory of convex functions, we saw, hey, we have the thermodynamic limit. So first, if you take the thermodynamic limit of log Zn, where n is the capital N for the finite system, that's of course what you cannot compute for the SK model, but Z to the N you can. And then average over the randomness, that's the point, you average it over the randomness, and then you differentiate with respect to a small n, which is the replica variable. That works nicely, but we have to interchange the thermodynamic limit. And the second problem is, we know z to the n for n is zero, clear, z to the n for n is zero is one, that's what everybody can compute. But then for n is 1, 2, 3, that's nice. But we extend it, we take the evident extension as a function of a real variable to n is 0. Is this extension unique? So we could boil down the question as to why the result of the replica symmetric solution was wrong. Because the limit, if you interchange the thermodynamic limit and differentiation in the neighborhood of n is at n is zero, then that's okay by the theory of convex functions, if you know that z to the n replica variable is a unique, and then 1 over n taking the limit log z to the n and doing it all correctly. And that's the technical stuff. If the extension is unique, then the answer must be right. Since the entropy is negative, the extension must be, that was our conclusion, the wrong one. And lo and behold, a year later, Parisi came with the replica symmetry breaking, which is, if I may say so, inspired guesswork. And that gave for the entropy something positive. It all looked okay. And we now know, after a thick book with highly complicated hard mathematics, you can even prove it. You do not need the inspired guesswork. But as we all know, the most efficient way of solving a problem is by means of the method of inspired guesswork. The only trouble is it's not a method, but okay, that's our bad luck. So, or the challenge of a theorist.
Before Parisi, there were a couple other proposals for breaking the replica symmetry. So what was your impression of those, or were you following that discussion at the time?
Well, if you have proven that the problem is in the extension from positive integer n of z to the n averaged. So 1 over capital N for the size of the system, logarithm of z to the n average, where z is the partition function of the system of size n. You take the limit n to infinity. You can prove, that's what we did, the thermodynamic limit is well defined. If you have then also shown that the problem is in the extension, the only solution is, if you want to know the solution, you must find the right extension. And why then bother about any other methods? These didn't work either. Waste of time. And I'm decently efficient, and that's why I didn't want to waste my time on that. Sorry, folks, that's it.
So when you moved to Heidelberg, you then joined with the SBF123 group.
Yeah.
About the stochastic mathematical stochastic modeling group. What was this collaboration, and what was this a natural fit for you?
That's a nice question. The SFB, that's the official German name. Now it's they call it the collaborative research, not research project, but it's a bad translation of Sonderforschungsbereich, is a special research project. It's a brilliant, I must say, a really brilliant German idea that has hardly been followed abroad, in that you collect a group of people who work on a single unifying topic. The topic should be well chosen. That's the art of making a good SFB, in that on the one hand, the number of people who can work on this topic is large enough. And on the other hand, it is small enough so that these people can also talk to each other and exchange ideas. So that's you have to choose this group and the topic, in particular the topic, you have to choose it well. The SFB in Heidelberg, with the nicest number that the German National Science Foundation could ever give, 1, 2, 3, that's what I'm still proud of. The SFB was highly successful. It existed for the maximum number of years, 5 times 3. After 3 years, it was re-evaluated. Maximal times was 4, so that the total existence was 15 years. It existed for the full 15 years, which tells you that the topic, and that was it, the topic was well chosen. It was on the one hand special enough, and on the other hand general enough. Probability theory played a very strong role in that, and that's why I found it so attractive, because just right. Now you need to know something that was in those days typical to the German academic system. If you ever wanted to get a professorship, then you had to pass, so to speak, an exam, an admission exam. And that was the habilitation, which you also have it in Russia, which is a second PhD, so to speak. In France, it's the test de doctorat d'état, which you get after your first PhD. So typically, I would say, in my days, it was 6 years. Can you still get it?
I think it's now called Habilitation à diriger des recherches in France. Changing it.
Okay. Sorry, I must laugh. Habilitation.
Yes.
Yeah, fits. But in Germany of the old days, it was the habilitation. And that was the entrance exam for professorship, the necessary but not sufficient condition to get a professorship. And I started in Heidelberg with a theory of laser physics, but I quickly got the freedom to work on spin glasses. And in fact, after 4 years, in 1983, it was re-evaluated. In 82, I had gotten my habilitation with my spin glass model. And then they gave me ample of time to work on my own topics. Yeah. Once in Heidelberg or in Germany, you are Privatdozent. You are not paid for that. But to keep the title, you must give a lecture or a seminar during each term, non-paid for. It's not paid for, you just give it for free, and then you can have your title. And you need that if you want to become a professor. Then you needed that, otherwise no way. In this way, you then also get ample experience with teaching. Of course, you can say, at Duke, you have already had an extensive and rather hard training in giving good lectures, because those who were not good were thrown out rather quickly. And to comfort you, mathematics was okay. For each term, I had two courses which were the same. That was the usual regulation. In physics, in those days, each term you had to give two different new courses. Two different new courses. You came up for tenure after 5 or 6 years, two different new courses per semester. That was damned hard. Horrible. Just horrible. Be that as it may. So, I would say the setup in Heidelberg was such that I could get my habilitation with my spin glass model. And then I also solved another hard-boiled problem, but that's not for now. Okay, so I hope this answers the question. I had the great luck of getting involved in the SFB 123, whose chair, that's also important to say, was an excellent scientist. It was an applied mathematician, Willy Jaeger. Willy Jaeger was a very good organizer with really bright ideas as to what to do and how to do it. My direct boss was belonged to the old German nobility, Wilhelm Freiherr von Wallenfels, a very nice guy who gave me a lot of freedom. And I still greatly respect that he gave me so much freedom, because spin glasses was, as you say in Munich, that was not his beer. Nevertheless, the product I produce had a good quality, so I could continue this way. That's also due to Willy Jaeger and the SFB. It was a really good place, fantastic. Franz Wegener was the physicist in those days, who was did wonderful work in renormalization group theory. It was just a great place.
And you were recruited to be part of that effort. You were not one of the founding members, right?
No. Okay. I arrived there at the first date when the SFB started. That was September 1st, 1978. So in a sense, I was lucky and I could stay there for 10 years altogether.
So a couple of years later, you started to collaborate with Ingo Morgenstern, who was also at Heidelberg at that point. What led you, and especially to look at numerical simulations, which I think was the first time you started working on numerical simulations. What led you to be interested in this problem?
We were far more efficient than you suggested. Ingo did the numerical formulations, simulations. I did the formulation of the mathematical theory. In those days, together with my first assistant in Heidelberg, said that was the German setup. Once you had your habilitation, which was in 1983, then you could, the year thereafter, or let me think, Papa, in 1982, I had got my habilitation. In 83, I got my first full position for a postdoc. And together with a Dutch postdoc, Arnoud van Enter. Arnoud and I did the mathematical theory, that was also when in the days when I made the write-up for my spin glass model. Imagine how boring it must have been for the two, my graduate student and Arnoud as my first assistant. Each morning, Leo was telling them how he thought that one should develop the full mathematical theory for his spin glass model. Must have been a hard time for them. Of course, I had to work damned hard myself to fill out all the details, but that was fun. We did the mathematics and thought also about what equilibrium statistical mechanics could mean in the spin glass context. That was in those days by no means evident. And of course, you can then ask, what is equilibrium? And B, what does it mean for a spin glass? That was not evident. Andrew Inglo collaborated with Andrew in later days with Andrew Ogielski. And he was allowed to leave for the US. He was then at Bell Labs and worked with Andrew. Whereas I, after I had gotten my habilitation and was privaatdocent, happily stayed in Heidelberg. Every now and then I visited Ingo at Bell Labs. That was fun. We'll come back to him in a minute. But he did the numerics. And let's be honest, the large-scale numerical simulations that he did together with Andrew Ogielski, these were, in those days, huge numerical simulations, the more or less the upper limit of what you could do. That's what Ingo did with him. And he could show that was more or less, the whole project was a collaboration. Ingo did the numerical simulation. We did the mathematically founded theoretical physics, Ingo the numerics. And it was Ingo's conclusion, what the spin glass performs is an equilibrium phase transition at a critical temperature. What happens below TC, that was something completely different. It was all Monte Carlo. But the spin glass had an equilibrium phase transition, different from what happens below TC. And my spin glass model predicted for a spin glass with an easing and isotropy, only two phases connected by up and down symmetry. Well, that was all okay, that fit, but that's what they showed. And what happened below, well, that's a still ongoing discussion, how to characterize the spin glass below TC, but what they could show, and also supported by more analytical work of Bray and Moore, which was already presented at the Heidelberg Colloquium on Spin Glasses in 1983, I had the fun to edit the proceedings together with Ingo. I did most of the editing. Ingo didn't like that. As I had spent my time at the US, I know how to do it. And I would say the lecture notes in physics that runs under proceeding, that's Heidelberg Colloquium on Spin Glasses. That was a book that was sold out in a few years, which, as you may know, does not happen to all the lecture notes in physics. But this one was sold out after a few years.
So I wanted to get back to this meeting in a few questions. But first, you mentioned your collaboration with your first PhD student, Canisius, and your postdoc, Van Enter. Were you working on a novel a newly proposed model for spin glasses, which you proposed yourself first, but in which replicas were not necessary to study. So what was the drive to formulate and to study such a model in your mind at that point?
First, to cook up a an exactly soluble model that in one way or another you could solve mathematically straightforwardly. That in we used in those days a new technique that of large deviations. It was really new. Because of the SFB, I had the great luck, must have been 81 or in the winter of 81, 82, there was, we had a visitor, Richard Ellis, who gave a series of lectures, and also a colleague of mine who also became a privatdozent in mathematics. He was really very interested in the theory of large deviations. When I saw that, I thought, wow, that's interesting. I would like to know that. And then at the SFB, it provided me just the right context to learn and to see what you can do with large deviations. And then I realized, hey, the model I'm first, hey, you get an idea. And the Mattis model, Xi I, Xi J, doesn't work. Because, and here I must say, there was also in those days a strong interaction. Gérard Toulouse had taught us all, yeah, for a spin glass, one of the ingredients is frustration. Without frustration, it's no good. Okay, the Shorrington Kirkpatrick model had a lot of frustration, but so has mine. So that was good. And the big advantage is I could solve mine straightforwardly without using the replica method. So there's no discussion. And then afterwards came the confirmation by Ingo. Say during the Heidelberg colloquium on spin glasses, we still had hot discussion whether there should be any transition, and if so, or whether or not it should be an equilibrium transition. And then Bray and Moore said, yeah, it's quite plausible that it is an equilibrium transition. It's quite plausible. But what happens below, they didn't know either. Anyway, so that was, so to speak, in the air. And what I wanted was having an exactly soluble model. And then Ingo came and said, yeah, fits, because I only get two connected by spin flip symmetry. That's what you can also clearly see in the PRL of Ogielski and Morgenstern. It all, that fit. It was a collective, undertaking where, say, what I did with my assistant, Arnold van Ente, was also thinking about interesting equilibrium statistical mechanics models, no connection with spin glasses, but containing randomness. That was new. Long range interactions, how can you solve that? There's a whole bunch of interesting questions, problems, models that you can study and solve.
So were you then aware of Bernard Derrida's work on the random energy model, which had similar objective as this program?
Yes, but Bernard Derrida had, that model is, from my point of view, rather different. I have been inspired strongly by John Maydosh. Already in, early 80s, I visited John at Leiden. You realize that I was born, grew up in Groningen. So each summer, my wife and when the kids came and the kids went to our parents, then I had the opportunity to stay there for a few weeks to visit Leiden. I have had strong interaction with John Maydosh. And the metallic spin glass of the copper manganese type or iron gold, you also need to know my background is actually not in statistical mechanics, but in solid state theory, as it was called in those days. Of course, you can say condensed matter theory is okay, but solid state theory. And in fact, I've spent my master student time at the solid state physics lab in Groningen, a nice old building, 1895. Just the classical stuff, wonderful place. So that was my background. And then spin glasses, that agreed very well with my original background in solid state physics. Then you see, it's not only statistical mechanics, but I came from solid state, and then at Duke, Richard Palmer, that is again solid state physics. That tastes good. Life is that simple. Then you see a consistent picture arising, and the interaction with Richard continued for a few years. Also due to Richard, I came into contact with the Hopfield model many years later. You know, Hopfield was 82. It was also due to Richard. And that put me onto another track after I had got my PhD and finished my spin glass model. I think after a few years, you should start with something new.
That's the plan. But I wanted to now look back to the conferences, the two workshops you organized with Ingo Mørgensen. Mm-hmm. How did these come about, right? What was the idea? And I mean, they were very successful, as you mentioned. But was it obvious that these workshops needed to take place, for instance?
No, that was the idea of Ingo Mørgensen and myself. And because we were in an SFP, there was money. Oh. Otherwise, you can forget about it. But the SFP was willing to invest money in well-organized meetings that were devoted to a fascinating topic. And thanks to its chair, Willy Jaeger, who had an open eye also for giving younger people the chance to more or less give themselves a bit of, you have to work hard. If you have ever organized a meeting, the best organized meeting is so well organized that you do not notice anymore its organization. That's the best organized meeting, but it's there. You have the idea that things all run smoothly. They don't. So, but due to the SFP, we had the opportunity. And of course, picking the right people, that was a job that Ingo and I myself did. Let's be honest, that's what Ingo and me, we both have picked people and invited them to Heidelberg to start with then the Heidelberg Colloquium on Spin Glasses.
Which, and the proceedings were very influential, as you described. In the, a bit in that spirit, at about the same time, with a different motivations, there's a community in mathematical physics that are start to try to demonstrate the Parisiansatz, starting with the work of Eisenmann and Pasteur and then Guerra. Were you following that work? Were you interested in
two remarks. One, you quickly skipped making proceedings. If you do it well, it is by no means evident that you will get good proceedings. I have actually done the editing work of the Heidelberg Colloquium on Spin Glasses, and it was damned hard work. You have to go through the manuscripts, and in those days, you then you Xerox them, and many authors have gotten them back from me with nicely red colored, and they had to change that, and realizing that my English and my remarks were correct, they did so. And you can take a critical look at the Heidelberg Colloquium on Spin Glasses, and you will see it's well edited. Yeah, the ordering, how you just well edited, nice topics, and you invite the speakers together with a topic, not to talk on anything. On an interesting topic, of course, fit to them. That's the purpose of the exercise. Then two, I think myself, I followed all these developments. I followed them, but at a distance. It was about 1985 that I decided I've contributed my part, my chunk, to the spin glass problem. In hindsight, I was not that wrong, because for the next 20, 30 years, did there happen that much? No, at least not from my point of view. Because many, a huge amount of time has been spent on the Sherrington Kirkpatrick model. David Sherrington is a good friend of mine. I like him very much. But with all my respect, I did not want to spend my time on eschatology, as many of these considerations were bloop. So I decided I'll turn to something else if it's interesting. And I'll tell you in a minute that spin glasses did contain something quite interesting, but from a different point of view. So as for the spin glass transition problem, I quit. And by accident, and it was also due to John Mydosh, who turned to low temperature behavior of spin glasses. Well, low temperature behavior of spin glasses, that means clear tunneling should become important. Well, if you have all these spin glasses, it's a magnetic moment. The spin quantum number S is say 4 or 5 or so. They are usually in an anisotropy. How then can a spin tunnel in an anisotropy? I thought I can find the problem in a thick book written by a brilliant Russian physicist, and it's all over. But it turned out there was no brilliant Russian physicist that had solved the problem. There was nothing. So together with André Schütte from the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, we solved the problem of, in particular, WKB for quantum spins, because only then could we answer the question of how does a spin glass behave when you have anisotropy? How then spins are going to tunnel? How do they tunnel? That's the first question, and you can talk about the rest. If it's frozen anyway, then tunneling remains. So that's how I came to tunneling of quantum spins, through the spin glass problem. Eh? Spin glass behavior at low temperatures. There you are. That took me, I think, 2 years or so, together with Andras. It was still, the Iron Curtain was still there. So spending your time at the Balaton during the summer, trying out each day another bottle of Hungarian white wine. I discovered the Hungarian white wines were not bad at all. With great respect, after 2 weeks, we had tried out as many Hungarian white wines, and I can only say they were good. Andres had a good taste. That's a nice side effect, but be that as it may. But that's how I got onto the tunneling of quantum spins and left the this endless discussion of what the spin glass transition really means and No, I turned to something.
Shortly after that, in 1986, you moved to the study of neural networks. So what led you to that research direction? You mentioned Richard Palmer's influence in making you aware of the Hopfield model, but was there something more immediate as well?
Yes and no. There is a very nice the combination of yes and no. You call that in German "Jein," which means or it's in between. Together with André Schütte, I published my tunneling of quantum spins WKB for tunneling of quantum spins paper in full generality. It's full blown generality. Europhysics Letters, Volume 1. It was a good volume. There were many more papers. It was fun, but it also contains the summary of our tunneling of quantum spins paper asset in full generality. You can't imagine it's all there. But when you think about the Hopfield model and then thinking, hey, how does the brain do it? Is that a Hopfield model? How does that work? And the Hopfield model provides a memory. But how does that work in reality? Okay, so that's how I then move to how does that work in reality to looking at real neuronal systems. And a neural system is for me an artificial thing. And by the end of the 80s, neural networks was already highly popular. Decently efficient, the computers weren't good enough yet, but neuronal system, how does nature do it? Well, that's something different. And in 1990, I got my appointment as the chair of theoretical biophysics of neuronal information processing at the Technical University of Munich. Well, and then afterwards, I could fully concentrate on that. So it was a flowing transition from spin glasses, tunneling of quantum spins, asking, how does that work in the brain? The Hopfield model is quite nice, but the brain, no doubt, must behave differently. Well, how then does it work? And instead of jumping fully into memory, as I'm a dynamically interested person, I first wanted to understand how does neuronal dynamics work? And then you have to answer a completely different type of question. Yeah? But dynamics is what I'm really interested in. And that's also why I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in equilibrium statistical mechanics and studying endless cases of renormalization group theory. That's a citation of Frederick the Great. Everybody should go to heaven in his or her own way, but let me then do it in my way. And I wish you the same. Become happy in your own way.
So as part of this transition, right, did you attend the workshop in Jerusalem at the Institute of Advanced Studies or the one in Santa Barbara, the Institute of Theoretical Physics? Were you involved in those discussions?
At Santa Barbara, yes. To my great regret, in those days, I was not invited to Jerusalem. For a Dutchman, this was a bit hard to accept, but that's it. Santa Barbara, yes. Richard Palmer, Dan Stein, and I myself. When was that? Something like 86 or so. Mm-hmm. We were there all three. Yep, that was fun.
So is that what led to the genesis of your PRL with Palmer and Stein in 1989, a few years later? Or
That was a consequence of our working together at Santa Barbara. Yeah. Would have been nice, but in those days, PRL is pretty good, but peer reviewing is not always completely impartial. But it's a well-cited physical review, physics letters A, together with you can look it up. Dates back to those days. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, correct.
And were you keeping, as you were transitioning and as you had left this world of spinning glasses, but did you stay abreast? Did you pay attention to what was happening in that field also, or did you cut the links more drastically?
I kept abreast of what was going on there. Don't forget that I have attended all the APS American Physical Society March meetings since I got appointed in Munich, or practically all, until COVID-19. Last year and this year, or last year was canceled. By accident, I had decided not to go. Thank heavens. Imagine you are there and then you are told, nice you are there, but we won't do it. That was a shame, a very bad style of the APS, but I've always been there. So that more or less enabled me to talk to people, to see what's going on there, listen to interesting talks, and then taking a look every now and then. So I followed it, but not intensely, because I've been decently productive also in the theory of neuronal networks. Spike timing dependent plasticity is meanwhile a textbook notion, but it stems from my chair.
Francesco, I think you had a question about this.
Yes, I wanted to know, you have a paper on the problem of unlearning. Okay. Adele. You have a paper on the problem of unlearning, which is something that was following up on previous work by John Hopfield. So why did you become interested in that specific problem?
I'll happily answer the question, but acoustically, the problem of what, Francesco?
Unlearning.
Unlearning. Ah, lovely. Lovely. Yes. That is just, again, you may say that was my contact with Richard. There was this lovely small paper in that was Nature, a single page or so, or even less than that. Hopfield, Richard, and who was the third one? I've forgotten. But that has attracted me over the years. I would still like to continue it a bit more on a theoretical level, because indeed in the early 90s I've published a few papers, and then even in Network I can send you my review in Network, which is a decent summary. The problem is clear. In a neuronal network, you get lots of data, and you can't store all these data because many of them are highly correlated. And I need not explain you guys, and nor anybody else who works on networks, as soon as you have correlated data, you have to discern them. How can you make your code so that it can discern highly correlated data? Unlearning does it. And the upshot of our work in Munich on the unlearning is that, and we could extend it to spiking neurons, spatiotemporal patterns with discretely functioning, so effectively spiking neurons. If you ask, what is unlearning good for? Then the answer is, it's highly efficient because you more or less, why do it? It's highly efficient because you allow the network more or less to load it practically to its maximal capacity. There is a maximal capacity for each coding system and each network. You can then practically load it up to its maximum. To formulate it in one sentence, the sense of unlearning is decorrelating correlated data. And the original idea that was also the motivation of John Hopfield. John Hopfield is an excellent biological physicist. the guy has always been motivated by biophysical problems. And that's fantastic. And this is, I think, a very good way to look at it, because unlearning, there is REM sleep was interpreted as an active way of unlearning. Whether that is really, it resembles rather well the algorithm that we now call unlearning in the theory of neural networks. But if so, it makes a lot of sense, because many data are decorrelated and you know yourself. Next morning, you suddenly look through the problem because apparently your brain has cleaned up the garbage and you can then know the solution. This feeling is what unlearning may well be good for in a neurophysiological sense. So I would say the sense of the meaning of REM sleep, or the implication of REM sleep, is just decorrelating correlated data. We have seen it theoretically for spiking networks and spatial-temporal problems. So it's highly probable, but the final proof is still missing.
So we have a few wrapping up questions to this interview. One of them is, you have a pretty solid understanding of both the European and the American physical communities, having spent a lot of time in both. Do you have any insight to offer as to why ideas of replica symmetry breaking, for instance, were received differently between the two communities, if they were?
I'll give the answer in the British way. I'm afraid there are differences. The American scene has always been far more reality-oriented than the European one. Paris, I've spent my postdoc at Paris, so I know the Parisian scene. It was a lovely state, but that's something different. The French have the French theoretical physics idea has every now and then the inclination to construct things that are slightly too lofty to be true. So a bit of realism is not only of practical value, it's for science, it's also necessary. I give you another example. That's from the theory of neuronal networks. When I arrived at Munich, there was about 1990, it must have been, there was a discovery of coherent oscillations in primate visual cortex. Coherent oscillations? So something like a bell rings with a frequency of 50 hertz. What is this good for? That's nonsense. That's what the Americans said. The Europeans said, no, it must be there. The upshot is both are right. The coherent oscillations do play an important role, but it is not as dominant as what the other party thought. So I would suggest, please listen to each other. And then we come down back to reality. That's far better.
During your time at Duke, at Heidelberg, or in Munich, did you ever get to teach a class on spinning glasses and replica symmetry breaking? If yes, can you detail what those classes were?
In Heidelberg, I was Privatdozent. Mm-hmm. So I did useful things mind you, with Richard Palmer, convexity. In Heidelberg, I've given a seminar on convexity and its applications for both the physicists and the mathematicians. So I've taught spin glasses quite often, Certainly also during my, say, the first 10 years in Munich, because the Hopfield model was still something that highly attracted the students, and I found it fun. So why not do it? The point is, symmetry breaking by itself in equilibrium statistical mechanics is a very important notion. And we won't delve, we could, but I think we won't delve into the question of fine. If we talk about symmetry breaking, can we specify the right order parameters? Choosing the right order parameters, we have to do that by means of the quote unquote method of inspired guesswork. That's, well, an art. So symmetry breaking is extremely important in physics, but you have to look at the context. Characterizing it, for that, you need order parameters, singular or plural. How to find them? Method of inspired guesswork, folks, otherwise it won't work. Replica symmetry breaking is exotic, if I may say so, because in either you use the replica method, a bright idea, absolutely wonderful, but then the next question will be in what context? And meanwhile, you both have seen, I doubt whether you have studied the book from cover to cover, the mathematical proof as to why the Parisi solution is indeed the correct one. I would say it's symmetry breaking, yes, extremely important. If it appears in some context, replica or whatever, then we have to take a careful look, because then it's physically irrelevant. So my answer is yes, it's relevant, as soon as you see its physical relevance. Have I taught that? Yes, I did. Not quite the, from my point of view, somewhat exotic Paris version. It's lovely theory, no doubt. But some theories in physics are lovely, but we need an experimental verification. And that may take some time.
Is there anything else you would like to tell us about this era that we may have skipped over, we may have missed?
It was an absolutely fascinating time. You can't imagine when I arrived at Duke. Yeah? Well, Patrick, you know, at the beginning of the term at Duke, so after Duke in those days started directly the day after Labor Day. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still true, isn't it?
And we start mid-August almost now. But there's air conditioning.
Okay, it was after Labor Day. It's still hot. The climate will turn over by October 1st. But you're standing there outside Duke, and then someone explains to you the spin glass problem. And then back in Europe, you visit John Maidosh, who has done this wonderful work. You get into contact with the experimental aspects of spin glasses. At Jülich they studied the non-metallic spin glasses, which I found a bit dry, to be honest, but that's a matter of taste. I like metals far better. And to understand that, you need to know that I've written my master thesis on night shift in liquid alkali alloys. Alloys, metals. And the night shift in liquid alkali alloys It had just been shown in this wonderful lab in Groningen that the night shift, which is a shift because of the conduction electrons, is linear, absolutely linear under concentration. You could take the experimental points, take a ruler, and draw a line through it. Okay, I've made the theory for that. It has been published. You can look it up. You need, believe me, you can look it up. And you will see that my theory goes exactly as a straight line through the data points. Even though the theory is nonlinear, it's a nonlinear theory, but it produces just straight lines through the data points. Anyway, that made me realize that solid state physics in metals, that's interesting stuff. So yes, wonderful. There you see. There you see. That's my coffee. The everything needs to be considered in its own context. And the rest, what you are going to do, depends on the prejudice you have gained during your study. I had the great luck of studying at a good university, at an excellent math department. The math department in Groningen was exceptionally good, including probability theory, because that primes you for the rest of your life. As a postdoc, you have no time to study a probability theory book. Either you know it or you don't, and that's it. Your background is to a big extent determining what you are going to do. That I then move through spin glasses. Tunneling of quantum spins is very logic as soon as you start pondering about low temperature behavior of spin glasses. Yeah? The spins are in an anisotropy. The spin quantum number is much bigger than a half. So there you are. Keep an open eye on what you will see. And I would say what happens in spin glass theory around 1980, and also, indeed, by accident, thanks to the Sonderforschungspreis, the SFB 123, we could organize the Heidelberg Colloquium on spin glasses. Personal meetings of this kind are worth gold when you are there. And that's important. People were able to talk to each other. There were no fights. In Heidelberg, there was a wonderful atmosphere. We have had so much fun. And not there was could have been a strong, even hot discussion, but people were always honest. The atmosphere was open, and that's fantastic. If people are just, oh, what does he say? Blah, 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 blah. And A may say everything, it may all be right, but B thinks it's wrong, and that's it. No, listen to another one. And that happened in those days. It was fantastic. That was fun. And for me, I honestly admit, in 1985, the game was over. We have understood the kind of transition and the details. Maybe you should also be honest and then think, can I contribute anything there? Mm-mm. Not for me. Let them run. And I was damned right, if I may say so in hindsight. It took 20, 30 years more. That's a bit long for a human life. I would say quit earlier. That's far better. So this makes you functioning, I would say, properly, because it keeps you creative. Yeah? And this starting period was one characterized by open mind and critical, but it was fun. Yeah? With great respect, the way in which, in particular, David Sherrington was there. Scott, I know Scott also from the time at Bell Labs. That was okay, But having David in Heidelberg, that's great fun, fantastic. Yeah. So it was a collaborative atmosphere where everybody tried to discover what spin glasses really meant. And in hindsight, I must say, Phil Anderson had put us on the right track. He could have said, oh, spin glass is very boring. As you know, he said the opposite. He was right. Phil, that's the person from whom Richard Palmer got his PhD. Richard had to leave the game, but as by the way, Ingo Morgenstern died by the end of last year. So I'm greatly shocked, but I learned it this morning. Ingo isn't among us anymore. But Phil Anderson, yes, he put us all on the right track. And that was really good. He stimulated a great development, characterized by open discussion, not dogmatic. Yeah?
Thank you. Finally, do you still have notes, papers, correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
That's a good point. Yes, I have an archive. Spin glasses, 1978, 2000, and I forgot what. I wanted to deposit that. Yes, correct. But in a sense, if you ask whether I have presented a well accessible overview of the thoughts I have developed on spin glasses and show some side remarks on what was happening there. My contribution to the Heidelberg Colloquium on spin glasses is, I still think, one of my very best papers. You may not say so of your own papers, but it's relative. So you may judge that as you like. Yeah. So that's a consistent overview that's well written, that explains, defines everything you want to know. Yeah, but my archive, I want to deposit it. And thank you for pointing this out to me. Now I know that I'm not the only one thinking this might be worthwhile.
We certainly think so. As you said, this was a fascinating time at an intellectual and personal and more level also beyond that. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for, say, letting me return to a fascinating period of my life.